The former was the economic side of the institution, the latter the chivalrous. The analogy of the aggregation of feudal groupings with crystallization is a very close one. As the historian watches the whirling and eddying confusion of the 4th and 5th centuries in Western Europe, he begins to perceive the appearance of these pyramidal growths of heads and subordinates and subsubordinates which jostle against one another, branch, dissolve again, or coalesce. We use the term feudal system for convenience sake, but with a degree of impropriety if it conveys the meaning systematic. Feudalism in its most flourishing age was anything but systematic. It was confusion roughly organized. Great diversity prevailed everywhere, and we shouldn't be surprised to find some different fact or custom in every lordship. Anglo-Norman feudalism attained in the 11th and 12th centuries a logical completeness and a uniformity of practice which in the feudal age proper can hardly be found elsewhere through so large a territory. The foundation of the feudal relationship proper was the fief, which was usually land, but might be any desirable thing as an office, a revenue in money or kind, the right to collect a toll or operate a mill. In return for the fief, the man became the vassal of his lord. He knelt before him, and with his hands between his lord's hands, promised him fealty and service. The faithful performance of all the duties he had assumed in homage constituted the vassal's right and title to his fief. So long as they were fulfilled, he and his heir after him held the fief as his property, practically and in relation to all under-tenants, as if he were the owner. In the ceremony of homage and investiture, which is the creative contract of feudalism, the obligations assumed by the two parties were, as a rule, not specified in exact terms. They were determined by local custom. In many points of detail, the vassal's services differed widely in different parts of the feudal world. We may say, however, that they fall into two classes, general and specific. The general included all that might come under the idea of loyalty, seeking the lord's interests, keeping his secrets, betraying the plans of his enemies, protecting his family, and so on. The specific services are capable of more definite statement, and they usually received exact definition in custom and sometimes in written documents. The most characteristic of these was the military service, which included appearance in the field on summons with a certain force, often armed in a specified way and remaining a specified length of time. It often included also the duty of guarding the lord's castle and of holding one's own castle subject to the plans of the lord for the defence of his fief. Theoretically regarded, feudalism covered Europe with a network of these fiefs, rising in graded ranks, one above the other, from the smallest, the knight's fee, at the bottom, to the king at the top, who was the supreme landowner, or who held the kingdom from God. But this was the theory that was superimposed upon the established facts. The reality of feudalism was its voluntary cooperation. The feudal state was one in which, it has been said, private law had usurped the place of public law. But rather is it truer that public law had failed and vanished, and private law had come in to fill the vacuum. Public duty had become private obligation. Third, we've already mentioned various kingdoms of the barbarian tribes who set up a more or less flimsy dominion over this or that area amidst the debris of the empire, the kingdoms of the Suevi and West Goths in Spain, the East Gothic kingdom in Italy, and the Italian Lombard kingdom which succeeded the Goths after Justinian had expelled the latter and after the great pestilence had devastated Italy. The Frankish kingdom was another such barbarian power, which arose first in what is now Belgium, and which spread southward to the Loire, but it developed far more strength and solidarity than any of the others. It was the first real state to emerge from the universal wreckage. It became at last a wide and vigorous political reality, and from it are derived two great powers of modern Europe, France and the German Empire. Its founder was Clovis, 481 to 511, who began as a small king in Belgium and ended with his southern frontiers nearly at the Pyrenees. He divided his kingdom among his four sons, but the Franks retained a tradition of unity in spite of this division, and for a time fraternal wars for a single control united rather than divided them. A more serious split arose, however, through the Latinization of the Western Franks, who occupied Romanized Gaul and who learnt to speak the corrupt Latin of the subject population, while the Franks of the Rhineland retained their low German speech. At a low level of civilization, differences in language cause very powerful political strains. For 150 years, the Frankish world was split in two, Neustria, the nucleus of France, speaking a Latinish speech, which became at last the French language we know, and Austrasia, the Rhineland, which remained German. We'll not tell here of the decay of the dynasty, the Merovingian dynasty, founded by Clovis, nor how in Austrasia a certain court official, the mayor of the palace, gradually became the king de facto and used the real king as a puppet. The position of mayor of the palace also became hereditary in the 7th century, and in 687, a certain Pepin of Heristal, the Austrasian mayor of the palace, had conquered Neustria and reunited all the Franks. He was followed in 714 by his son, Charles Martel, who also bore no higher title than mayor of the palace. His poor little Merovingian kings don't matter in the slightest degree to us here. It was this Charles Martel who stopped the Muslims. They had pushed as far as Tours when he met them, and in a great battle between that place and Poitiers in 732 utterly defeated them and broke their spirit. Thereafter the Pyrenees remained their utmost boundary. They came no further into Western Europe. Charles Martel divided his power between two sons, but one resigned and went into a monastery, leaving his brother, Pepin, sole ruler. This Pepin, it was, who finally extinguished the descendants of Clovis. He sent to the Pope to ask who was the true king of the Franks, the man who held the power or the man who wore the crown. And the Pope, who was in need of a supporter, decided in favour of the mayor of the palace. So Pepin was chosen king at a gathering of the Frankish nobles in the Merovingian capital Soissons, and anointed and crowned. That was in 751. The Franco-Germany he united was consolidated by his son, Charlemagne. It held together until the death of his grandson, Louis, in 840. And then France and Germany broke away again, to the great injury of mankind. It wasn't a difference of race or temperament. It was a difference of language and tradition that split these Frankish peoples asunder. That old separation of Neustria and Austrasia still works out in bitter consequences. In 1916, the ancient conflict of Neustria and Austrasia had broken out into war once more. In the August of that year, the present writer visited Soissons and crossed the temporary wooden bridge that had been built by the English after the Battle of the Aisne from the main part of the town to the suburb of Saint-Médard. K. canvas screens protected passengers upon the bridge from the observation of the German sharpshooters who were sniping from their trenches down the curve of the river. He went with his guides across a field and along by the wall of an orchard in which a German shell exploded as he passed.